This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we've got David Borden, who's the executive director of the Drug Reform Coordination Network. Turns out that some 200,000 students haven't been able to get their school loans because of drug busts.
The government wants you to know that next time you pick up a joint, you may lose your student loan.
Amnesty International has just issued a new report on Guantanamo.
Camp 6, a supermax prison at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo, and worse, torture by imprisonment.
All that and more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
We want to update listeners on a number of outrages that have happened during the last week. One that really struck me hard was the awarding of the Pulitzer Prize to the Daily News editorial writers for their coverage of the health risks and the health issues that came after the World Trade Center attack after 9/11. First of all, the Pulitzer Prize is given to the major and best supposed journalists in the country, the best newspapers and the best stories that are written. And it's given again here to the Daily News, a New York City daily, for its 2006 editorial coverage of the health effects of the World Trade Center collapse. Why I was really taken by this story is not that they didn't deserve the prize for that work. Yeah, they did a good job on that. But one of the columnists at that paper is Juan Gonzalez. A lot of the listeners out there know Juan Gonzalez. He's a co-host of Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. I knew Juan way back at Columbia days when we were doing SDS and other kinds of work in the late 60s and 70s. But Juan was really the first journalist out there to write and talk about the health effects of the World Trade Center collapse after 9/11. And he wrote his first article in October 2001 warning that this was a dangerous health situation, that the air was no good, it was going to make people sick. He wrote 15 columns between then and 2002, and he wrote a book. It came out in 2002 called Fallout, The Environmental Consequences of the World Trade Center Collapse. A very important book, the first book in the area, 2002. But at the Daily News, from what I understand, from what's out there, people were not happy at the Daily News with his stories. Didn't believe it, didn't think they had the evidence, tried to suppress his columns, tried to do all kinds of things. This is 2001, 2002. But he's out there telling people, listen to this. The newspapers in the country are saying it's safe. Michael Smith will tell us how Christine Todd Whitten was down there saying it's safe. And had people listened to Juan, there would be a lot less illness and sickness today from 9/11. People would not have gone down there and stayed down there and gone back into their homes much, much later. So what happens? We come to last week, and who should get the prize, the Pulitzer, but the Daily News for their coverage of the 9/11 sickness? Juan is given no credit for it, and the very newspaper that tried to make it difficult for him to report on it gets the Pulitzer Prize. And worse, people got sick and ill because Juan was not listened to. So it's really, to me, an outrage of the week, an outrage in terms of the Pulitzer Prize, and really not giving credit for the important pioneering work of Juan Gonzalez.
It's really a discredit to the Pulitzer Committee and shows that they're the handmaidens of corporate media to ignore Juan like that. You know, I live down there. I live in Battery Park City, literally across the street from Ground Zero. I got a pet talking parrot. We took him up to Michael Ratner's house because we couldn't live down there anymore after 9/11. On the 12th of September, we walked up to the village with the bird in the cage, and he kept saying, it's okay, to every passerby. But when we moved back into our apartment, the bird started falling off his perch. We rushed him up to the Animal Medical Center. You know, and here in New York, they got a specialist for parrots only. She checked him out, and she said, that'll be $900, please. I said, what? He was a victim of terrorism. So the doctor said, well, in that case, we'll provide medical care for free. And she gave him an IV. She gave him antibiotics. She nursed him back to health. But I thought then, you know, this is like the canary in the mineshaft. You know, what Juan Gonzalez was starting to write about it just afterwards, what he was saying was absolutely true. And then 2 years later, I developed a thing called achalasia, where almost all the nerves in my esophagus died, and I can't swallow. And I went to the specialist at NYU, and what does he say? You know, it could have been from the pollution in the air after 9/11. Well, you know, thanks very much, Christine Todd Whitman, for assuring everybody that was totally safe down there when the real reason was that they wanted to open up Wall Street. And my real gratitude goes to Juan Gonzalez, because he was the only one that exposed it back then, and he should have got the credit from the Pulitzer Committee.
If people care about this issue, and this is not what anything that Juan has said, but from our point of view as Law and Disorder, they ought to write to the Daily News, write to the Pulitzer Committee. We'll put some links up on our page and say, what is this about? Why have we ignored really the one person who could have probably made Michael Smith's, our co-host's, health better and the health of a lot of other people? Why was he suppressed, and why was the very newspaper that suppressed it actually given a Pulitzer for
it? A lot of people. I belong to the New York State Trial Lawyers Association, and we're doing pro bono work for a lot of these people who got sick down there. Michael Ratner, you were over in Europe and Paris and Berlin for a week, and you came back to a hell of a week. What's it like re-entering?
You know, it's serious out there. I mean, we got to understand that we have to do something dramatic to change this world right now. Because the first thing you read, 157 people were killed in Iraq. I mean, this is after the so-called escalation surge, as they call it. Things certainly don't seem to be getting better. And in fact, I think what we may see happen in Iraq is something like the Tet Offensive at some point that will eventually drive the United States out militarily, and just the American people will finally say, we've had it. We see the Democrats screwing around with a timetable in their legislation, but not linking that really to any funding, just putting it in, Bush claiming to veto it, and realize people are being slaughtered every single day in Iraq. I mean, I don't know what you can say about it, Michael. I mean, it's just...
Well, you can say the chickens are coming home to roost because you came back and opened up the paper and you read about what happened in Virginia.
Right. And then, of course, you know, this does not happen in other countries of the world. In a normal course of a day, people picking up weapons and just murdering scores of people. It happens in this country.
Repeatedly.
It's about guns. It's about violence. It's about, you know, the very people that are creating violence abroad, it's violence at home. It's the same. It's two wings of the same violent bird. I got to tell you that.
I suppose most of our listeners have seen Michael Moore's excellent movie Bowling for Columbine, analysis of what happened out in Colorado. And I just read yesterday that right outside of that high school in Colorado where those two kids killed all those people, they want to put up a statue of a Navy SEAL fighting in Afghanistan, the guy standing on a pedestal holding up a rifle. Don't they put two and two together? You know, if you have these kinds of wars abroad, it comes home.
It comes home. It's violence abroad, violence at home, or violence at home and violence abroad. And it's the same thing with happens with fundamental rights and liberty. We create tyranny abroad, tyranny in Iraq, tyranny in other countries that we dominate, and we create tyranny at home, because you need that tyranny to control a population that is going to say at some point, it's enough. It's enough. In an area we don't usually cover on this program, the area of abortion. Now, people know that since abortion was allowed in the 70s by the Supreme Court and said to be really a fundamental right, that the right wing in particular and anti-abortion people have made huge efforts to try and whittle away at a woman's fundamental right to choose whether to have a child or not. We're allowed to have an abortion within the first two trimesters, that's the first 6 months, and slowly they've been whittling away. And today's decision was really the biggest chink in that block of trying to whittle away a fundamental right, and that was the upholding 5-4 in the Supreme Court, the two new appointees, Roberts and Alito, voting with the majority, 5-4, to uphold a congressional law called by its proponents the partial birth abortion law. It prohibits a particular type of procedure for giving an abortion, usually that takes place in the second trimester, which is the 3-6 month period. I'm no expert on it, but I know that while it talks about a procedure, what it's really getting at is trying to slowly strangle the right of abortion during the second trimester.
You know, I remember when the abortion law was made national, and I remember before that, when we were growing up in the 50s and the 60s, and one of our friends got pregnant, and how we'd panic because there was like one doctor in Philadelphia that you could go to, and there was another one in Puerto Rico. I mean, you know, it was just a terrible situation. And what a relief it was when abortion became legal and women could control their own bodies in this country. And I never thought that that would get reversed.
Neither did I.
But they've been steadily, increasingly encroaching and bringing in their theocratic view of the world and bringing in their religion into our government. So now you had, you've got these two religious people, Scalia, the latest Roberts, bringing in that view, which is essentially it's a Catholic notion that from acorns you get oak trees, so therefore you can't destroy the acorn. So therefore you can't destroy a couple of cells that are inside of a woman's body.
So we're talking about president, we're talking about courts, and we're talking about, even though we have a slight majority in the Senate and Democratic Congress, people willing to stand up. So we're in a serious place between the war in Iraq, between civil liberties at home, between the right to abortion. People have to understand this is a time that is, we're really entering a dark period in our own lives and in the lives of this country and in the world.
No, I agree with you. The Congress is no good. The executive branch under Bush is no good. Supreme Court hangs in the balance. You know, you got Stevens, who's a relative liberal on the Supreme Court. He's 87 years old. You got the corporate media that aren't helping us very much. There's another branch outside of government that can do something about it, and that's all of us. You got to hope that there'll be some mass mobilizations and some real outcries here. We've had some big setbacks.
I know, Michael, you always talk about the need for a party, and when you look at what's going on in the country, you know, here I work at the center very heavily. We work against the war, but we really are on Guantanamo and torture right now. Other people are working on abortion. Others are working on gun control. Others are working on the Iraq war. And so what we all have is our issues out there that we're fighting on, but we're really not fighting together. In some way, we're not winning. There's not a real, what you would have to call a grassroots, essentially, need for a revolutionary struggle at the base that understands that what's going on in the country is across the board, from the religious right, you know, the whole set. And as long as we're atomized, fighting separate issues, I think we're not going to win.
I think the lesson that we learned from the 60s was this, that the movements have to come together, not just for their separate issues, but combine them. And we have to have kind of a coordinated movement because everything's interrelated and the enemy's the same.
I mean, look at immigration. Immigration, at least on that level, there was mass movements on immigration in this country. But again, if it was a mass movement as part of a much larger movement on all these issues, think of the chances we would have.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a sad thing, and we can't sit by us saying that we need this. It's not going to happen. But I can tell you that we're not going to win these various individual struggles until we look at this as one big struggle.
No, I think our parents' generation failed in organizing an independent political party. You and I, Michael, generation of the 60s radicals, we failed in doing that. And I think that that's the task for the people younger than us. Anyway, getting back to your shock of immersion back into America, coming back from Europe, Michael, and seeing all these terrible things happening, what did you do over in Europe? What were you trying to accomplish over there? Is it a little easier over there than over here?
Well, you know, Europe, at least on some level, still understands the idea of being a legal state or a lawful state. So they still believe that you have to have certain fundamental rights and laws. And look, they're not perfect. No state obviously is. And, you know, I'm not a member of a state for good reason. But Europe at least understands the torture is outside of the parameters they do at this point. Look, they had 400 years of war killing each other as if we were fighting against Pennsylvania and Delaware, you know, next door to each other. But after 400 years, they seem to have learned at least some of the states how to live together and how to understand law. In any case, I went first to Paris, where it's interesting. I was hosted by a group called Democrats Abroad. That's essentially the Democratic Party
in Paris.
And what's interesting is, you know, here I am from the Center for Constitutional Rights, founded as a radical organization, still considers itself a radical organization. But because the issues we're now representing people on, which is Guantanamo and torture and the war, are so outrageous what the Bush administration has done, that there are Democrats who are saying, what is going on in this country? And they're willing to say, we want to support the center. We want to stop torture. We want to close down Guantanamo. So that was interesting because I'm sitting next to people who, you know, used to work for Time magazine or, you know, places that, you know, magazines that I don't even get, you know, not to say what I think about them, certainly during those periods. But so these are people that demonstrates to me that there is a depth to the opposition to some of these issues, particularly abroad. And they said to me, what they said, Michael, give us some way that we can actually feel proud of anything our country is doing. Because when I go up to the Europeans come up to us, they just said, you're from America, and they practically spit at them. Because Americans are in such disrepute, even this set of people from very respectable, so-called respectable backgrounds and jobs living in Paris. So that was Paris. But then I went to Germany, which is where many of our listeners know the Center for Constitutional Rights has this lawsuit against Rumsfeld for torture and trying to get a criminal investigation. And we're doing some follow-up on that. We haven't gotten a decision from that. I don't necessarily at this point expect an optimistic decision. I expect we're most likely going to lose in that attempt. But we were really trying to think about what would happen if we lost and what country would we go to next.
So where'd you going?
Well, I think we're going to go to Spain next. And Spain is really interesting here. Not only is that where the Pinochet case happened, but two of our Guantanamo detainees are sitting in Spain having been tortured. And so it gives Spain a link with the case. I think Spain is interested in the case. We'll see what happens in Germany first. I still am hopeful about Germany, but I'm not optimistic, really. But the real point of that the series of meetings we had with Spanish lawyers and other lawyers was to come up with a strategy to make sure that we would be able to pursue Rumsfeld essentially till the end of his days.
And not just Rumsfeld, the whole coterie of torturers.
Oh, Tenet, head of the CIA, the whole crowd. You know, Europe is interesting now. They have these prosecutions against CIA people who were involved in outsourcing torture, rendition, and they opened the trial this very week that we're recording the show. They opened the trial against the U.S. soldier Lozano, who they alleged was involved in the killing of the Italian intelligence agent in Iraq after he had freed Giuliana Sabrina.
You know, the guy's from New York. While you were overseas, he issued a statement saying that he had every right to shoot them, that either you shoot them or they shoot you, and you got certain rules, and when they're within 100 meters, you shoot them. And that's what he did, and he's not sorry for what he did.
Yeah, it was actually a New York brigade that was involved. I think it was the 69th, and actually they used to be known as the Fighting Irish. I think that's the brigade. But he does live in Manhattan, actually, I think, the guy. And he may not be the most guilty of the crowd. I mean, you know, was he trained right? What was he told to do? Who instructed him? Why did he shoot at Giuliana Sagrina and the agent? I mean, the agent was killed because he tried to protect Giuliana Sagrina. So what were they doing? They were trying to kill this Italian journalist who'd just gotten freed, you know, by the behest of her government. It's a very, very peculiar circumstance. In any case, that trial is opened in Italy. It was immediately adjourned and will be continued in the middle of May with a trial of this man named Lozano, I think, person from the U.S. military, and they're trying to get into the higher-ups. So Europe's an interesting place right now. I mean, it makes you feel that, you know, at least they have some semblance of law and of civilization left, although, you know, it's uneven, but something's going on there, and certainly opposition to the U.S. policies. Today we're joined by David Borden, the executive director of the Drug Reform Coordination Network. He's going to talk to us about the Higher Education Act of 1998. I think you'll be as surprised as I was when you hear what this act does. It denies loans to college students who have been convicted of drug offenses. Since the act's passage in the year 2000, when it went into effect, 200,000 college students have been denied loans. Pretty amazing. The government wants you to think about it a lot before you pick up that next marijuana joint, because they want to tell you you will lose college loans if you do. To talk to us about some of the efforts to reform that act, to remove that provision, a provision that's completely outrageous, we're happy to have David Borden with us today.
Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We heard you were down in Washington lobbying on the Higher Education Act with respect to a drug provision in it.
Yes, this is a very timely moment to look at this issue because it's active in Congress right now, and this very week, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee of the U.S. Senate is working on the HEA reauthorization. This is one of the issues that they are hopefully taking up.
What is the issue, David, that we're concerned by in terms of the drug provision?
Well, what the drug provision does, and it's also called the aid elimination penalty, it trips would-be students who have drug convictions of their eligibility for federal Title IV college aid.
What level of offense do you need to be stripped of your aid?
It's any offense at all, any state or federal offense.
You're kidding. Even a marijuana conviction?
Yes. Now, it doesn't, depending on what type of convictions and how many you have, it doesn't necessarily last forever. And it was scaled back about a year ago so that the offenses that count are limited to those while you are in school and receiving Title IV aid. But we still think it's a pretty bad idea.
Wait, let me see if I get this. If you're going to a school like in Washington, near Washington Square Park or something, and you go in and you smoke a joint and you get busted by the cops while you're in school receiving a scholarship through this program, you lose the scholarship and that's it?
No, you lose the loan, not even
that's
a scholarship.
That's what I mean, the loan.
You lose any federal aid, be it scholarships, loans, or even work study. For a first-time possession conviction, it would be for a period of 1 year. There is a treatment provision to get it back, but that will probably take you a semester to complete. It might cost as much as your financial aid was, not necessarily at NYU, but at York Community College, for example, where we have a scholarship program where we supported someone for 2 years until he got other kinds of aid back. And the treatment programs might not take you if you were just smoking a joint, and they have people with real problems to help.
We're talking with David Borden, who is the executive director of the Drug Reform Coordination Network. David, how many students has this provision affected since it was enacted back in the 90s?
It was enacted in 98. The first school year cycle for which it took effect was the 2000-2001 school year. And it's affected roughly 200,000 people. At least that's the number of applicants for aid denied cumulatively over those years. Now, what we don't know is how many people were dissuaded from even applying for aid because they rightly or wrongly believed that they would be found ineligible.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, a dramatic number.
I used to do legal services work out right next door to York College. It's out in South Jamaica, which is it's a minority school. David, in your estimation, has this law knocked out more minority people of color students than others? I mean, what's the demographic breakdown?
Well, there are no demographics specific to this penalty. The government has not provided them. I'm not sure if they even can. I don't think the financial aid forms request ethnicity information. However, if we look at the larger statistics of drug enforcement, they're greatly disparate. African-Americans and whites, for example, use drugs at roughly the same rates, but the imprisonment rate for blacks is about 4-1. And for convictions, the disparity is a little less than that, but it's quite large. Now, we don't know exactly how that plays out when you limit the set of people you're looking at to those who are trying to go to school, but it's such a big disparity that we believe it must be playing out.
Well, what do you say to people who say, look, there's just a limited amount of money to loan out to kids that want to go to college. Why should we give preferential treatment to drug users when other people need this money? And they shouldn't be out there committing these crimes anyway. This'll teach them a lesson.
Well, I say, one, if you don't think that they've been taught a lesson already by being dragged through the criminal justice system, possibly going to jail, paying fines, community service, many of them paying for lawyers. Clearly, they've been taught a lesson. They've been punished once already. And we don't think that this second punishment should be added on automatically. The judge has nothing to say about it, no power to remove it, unless there's some avenue for changing the charge into some non-drug charge, which happens occasionally, but mostly it can't happen. Why should these people be treated differently from anyone else? Certainly for drug offenses where it's not as if they've harmed other people.
You know, it's really, it's an outrage because you have an alleged crime being committed, even if a lot of us don't think marijuana smoking should be a crime. And then it's up to the judge or the criminal justice system to determine what happened to that person. But all of a sudden, every single person who goes through this without any discretion, without anything else, gets an additional penalty that has nothing to do with the underlying so-called criminality. You know, it reminds me of the felony disenfranchisement, where people are convicted of felonies and then they don't get the right to vote afterwards, which has nothing to do with the nature of the crime, the sentence, or anything else, but is simply an imposition like that. It's medieval, really, in a certain way to do this kind of thing.
A case came to our attention in Washington State in which the judge required of the student that he complete school as a condition of getting probation.
Wow.
And the loss of financial aid.
Catch 22.
That's amazing. Now, can you tell, has anybody done any studies of what happens to the students who lose these scholarships? They all wind up going back. Do some of them get, are there issues around what happens to those students? Or has anybody done anything about looking at them?
They probably go to Iraq.
There haven't been studies of specifically what happens to people affected by this law, but there is research showing that people who go to school, people who stay in school, complete it at higher rates and perform better in their endeavors in society.
Who's out there opposing it, and what can people do on this show to oppose it? But tell us a little bit about the opposition, and then give us some tips for our listeners where they can go to a website, they can do something to oppose this really, really nasty law.
Well, the leader of the opposition is one of the most conservative members of Congress in the knee-jerk conservative category, I would say. That's Mark Sauter, member of Congress from Indiana, and he got this passed on a voice vote in committee. There are other supporters, but no one else really passionate about it. In the Senate, our worst opponent probably is Judd Gregg from New Hampshire, who helped get this passed in the first place. What people can do about it, as I mentioned before, it's a very timely moment. Senator Clinton is a member of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, HELP, and they are looking at the HEA reauthorization right now, possibly completing the initial version of the Senate bill this week. That may or may not happen, and so that may be done by the time this airs, but the issue will certainly not be done by then. The phone number for her office in Washington is 202-224-4451, and we're asking people to call her up and ask her to work to ensure that repeal of this law that takes financial aid away from students who have drug convictions is repealed in full as part of the Higher Education Act reauthorization this year. 202-224-4451. I have a New York City number also. It's better to use the Washington number for this kind of call, but people who need to call locally, that number is 212-688-6262. We have a website, raiseyourvoice.com, that also follows this issue.
That's raiseyourvoice.com. People should go to that website. The act that we're trying to get this taken out of is called the Higher Education Act. It seems to me it should be a slam dunk. You're sitting with Democrats in both houses, but of course it never is. So get on the phone, work the phones. 200,000 students affected by this in 5 or 6 years, 40, 50,000 a year. It's a pretty staggering number. It just shows the direction we're going. And thanks to people like David Borden, who's the executive director of the Drug Reform Coordination Network, I think we have a chance, don't we, David?
I think we do, and the support appears to be much more firm on the House side of this. And so I think that gives us a real chance.
Keep up the good work, David.
Yeah, David. Thank you very much.
So recently, Michael, Camp 6 opened up a new camp, a new prison housing unit opened up in Guantanamo Bay. And from what I hear, it's not too good.
I think it's supposed to be, it was modeled on a supermax in the United States, but it got even worse than that. They were supposed to have a little recreation yard. They closed that. Now, has Amnesty been doing some work about Camp 6?
We've been monitoring, and about 100 inmates have been transferred there so far. I believe there's about 385 people left, inmates still on Guantanamo, and about 100, a third of them, have been transferred. And, you know, it is like a supermax facility. It seems really rough. The conditions are actually a little bit more severe than a supermax facility for people who are aware of what supermax is like in the U.S. But we're talking about really severe isolation, and this place was designed for that kind of isolation. It was built without windows, high concrete walls. People are kept in their individual cells for 22 hours a day. They have no fresh air, no windows to the outside. The people will remember when David Hicks was brought into court, he had grown his hair out to the middle of his back because the fluorescent lights had been kept on 24 hours a day in his cell. He couldn't take it anymore, so he grew his hair out to provide some sort of natural shield. Well, a lot of the same thing is happening with these guys. They've got lighting on for 24 hours a day, and for people who have very curly hair, sometimes growing it out like that is not an option. In terms of the temperature, it looks like they're really being controlled in a little bit of a punishing way. One of the lawyers who visited her client at Camp 6 was told by the client, look, it's just freezing in here, and it's consistently too cold. The air conditioning is too high. And this lawyer said when she was in the visiting room with her client, he was huddled on the floor trying to warm himself with his arms, and he was even too cold to sit on his chair. So what they've said is, okay, well, you know, we're actually giving them thermals. Instead of turning up the temperature to a comfortable level, they said that they've given them thermals to wear underneath their jumpsuits. However, it's at the discretion of the guards to take away those thermals if they want to punish the detainees. So just to give you an idea of what that's like, one detainee reportedly had his shirt taken away when he was found with a small item. I don't know what it was, but it was a very small item in his pocket when he went to the shower. He's not supposed to have anything.
What do they get, a shower a week? A 1 week, 2 a week? I don't remember. It's some very low number,
you know,
though.
I don't remember. I think it's about 1 a week. But, you know, also once a week. Most of these people have been there in Guantanamo for about 5 years. It's a really desperate situation.
This is the new camp.
This is a new camp.
And it's essentially tortured. 24-hour lights. I mean, almost no exercise. Yeah. And there was a small exercise yard built in the middle where the cells were supposedly to face or something. They are now afraid of anybody really exercising or congregating at all for whatever reasons, and they are not allowing them out into that.
My understanding is that they actually do get 2 hours of exercise a day in a yard that was, it's originally intended to be a communal sports and recreation area, but now it's been divided into individual areas.
Right, it's alone now. You have to exercise alone, right?
Yep. No touching, no handshaking, no communicating.
You described the communication, Dahlia. In the old ones, there was at least, we didn't like the hurricane fencing and all of that, but one side was open. I don't mean open you could walk out, but open so you could see out, and therefore you could actually talk and communicate with other prisoners. This one, as you said, nothing.
I mean, these aren't scary people. These are, you know, even the Uyghurs that we've talked about before. You can listen to the past segment that we had with Sabin Willett. He's an attorney out of Boston at a white shoe law firm that's taken on this case of Chinese Muslim Uyghurs who ended up in Guantanamo and have actually been affirmatively cleared by the government, by the Department of Defense. But China will not take them back. They suffer religious persecution there. Some of them have gone to, I believe, Albania, where they're living really miserable lives, and then some of them are still in Guantanamo. And unfortunately, it's reported that some of the Uyghurs who are still in Guantanamo, affirmatively cleared of everything, have been moved into Camp 6. So now, in addition to the isolation they were already experiencing, these people who've already been affirmatively cleared to leave Guantanamo but just can't, for lack of available country, have been put in Camp 6, separated out from each other. So they don't even have contact with each other, and sometimes you can shout to other inmates, but a lot of them have been mixed in with Arabic speakers. They don't speak, or Urdu speakers, and they don't speak those languages, so they just have no communication. This is obviously done very deliberately to demoralize, to bring people as low as they can. Even once a week, guards reportedly put up print articles from the internet, and they put it in this recreation area that people get. Well, they print everything up. You know, nearly all of it's in English, and most people don't read English. And it's not really news. It's pretty much propaganda. They put up a photo of Saddam Hussein, and at the time of his execution, with a caption from the U.S. military stating that he was, quote, executed because he did not cooperate with the Americans. On another occasion, captions had reportedly been added to pictures of children, along with the lines of, quote, Daddy, I don't remember what you look like. Please cooperate with the Americans so you can come home.
That one's really something. Wow. That's amazing, Dahlia.
Well, recently, Bashir al-Rawi, he was released back to England. And this is his statement that he released this month. He said, I'm delighted to be back home in England with my family. After 4 years in Guantanamo Bay, my nightmare is finally at an end. As happy as I am to be home, though, leaving my best friend Jamil Albana behind in Guantanamo Bay makes my freedom bittersweet. Jamil was arrested with me in the Gambia on exactly the same unfounded allegations, yet he is still a prisoner. He is the father of 5 young children, the eldest of whom is 10. He has never seen his youngest daughter, who is nearly 5 years old. He too should be released and reunited with his family. I also feel great sorrow for the other 9 British residents who remain prisoners in Guantanamo Bay. Some are now on hunger strike, protesting against their extreme solitary confinement. The extreme isolation that they are going through is one of the most profoundly difficult things to endure. I know that all too well. The hopelessness you feel in Guantanamo can hardly be described. You are asked the same questions hundreds of times. Allegations are made against you that are laughably untrue, but you have no chance to prove them wrong. There is no trial, no fair legal process. I was alleged to have participated in terrorist training in Bosnia and Afghanistan. I've never been to Bosnia, and the only time I visited Afghanistan was thanks to the hospitality of the CIA in an underground prison, the Dark Prison, outside Kabul. But now, finally, I am home. That was a statement from Bashir al-Rawi. That was only part of his statement. We can put the larger statement up on our website. People can visit lawanddisorder.org if they want to read the complete statement. He goes on to thank activists, Amnesty, his lawyers, Stafford Smith, and Gareth Pierce.
We're pleased now to be joined by Shane Katedel, who is an attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights and actually head of the Center's Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Shane.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
So, Shane, we've just had a few months to learn about Camp 6 since it's just been open, I believe since about January 2007. Tell us what you know about this camp.
Sure. Well, you know, to give you a little background, in the U.S. it's become very popular to build supermax prisons. Authorities call them administrative segregation or isolation facilities, but those are really euphemisms for these being solitary confinement prisons. And they were originally designed for the most dangerous prisoners, you know, people who had attacked guards or fellow prisoners or that sort of thing. And there the only solution might be to isolate someone for a limited time, you know, with what the Supreme Court has sort of mandated, that there be some process involved in being assigned to a solitary confinement facility, precisely because it is so sort of psychologically difficult to sort of get through being in solitary confinement. I'll talk a little about that in a minute. But the interesting thing about these things domestically is that they kind of have taken on a political momentum of their own. State officials build them because they want to be seen as tough on crime, and then they have to fill them. It's kind of, you know, if you build them, they will come sort of phenomenon. And that's really what happened in Guantanamo with Camp 6. They built this facility. They spent $30 million on it, and they claim that they built it to house the most dangerous prisoners at the base. But they immediately filled it with people from the lowest level security camp, Camp 4, which is where people who the government knew weren't a threat and were cleared to leave and that sort of thing had been put. And it was sort of like a dormitory. People were kind of living in communal living conditions. just like the Geneva Convention's mandate that POWs be held in. You know, they were all moved out of there basically because there was space available in the new facility in Camp 6. You know, now the government has sort of spun it even for those low security folks as saying, you know, look, they have better privacy because they have their own room now in solitary confinement. You know? Or that it's more state of the art.
My first class.
Brand new facility, right? You know, and it was primarily due to, you know, the military's concerns probably over the three deaths, which they claim were suicides in the middle of 2006. That seems to have changed military attitudes towards a lot of procedures there.
Tell us about those deaths.
Well, we don't really know a whole lot about them. You know, that's why we refer to them, you know, as deaths, because it's not clear that they were suicides. You know, certainly, you know, there have been a lot of suicide attempts at Guantanamo. It's, you know, something that comes from a combination of, you know, people not knowing when their detention is going to end or whether they'll ever have a chance to prove that they were wrongly detained in a court of law, plus the sort of abusive conditions that have been kind of well documented there at Guantanamo that, you know, these guys are forced to put up with for, you know, who knows how long, an indefinite period of time.
My understanding is that 165 prisoners, which is more than one-third of the population of Guantanamo inmates, have been transferred to Camp 6.
Yeah, that's right. And it really kind of puts a lie to the military's claims that these are, you know, people who violated disciplinary procedures. I mean, the reality is that the level of incidence at Guantanamo is lower than it is in most federal prisons. You know, but the conditions there really are pretty appalling. You know, first of all, it's total isolation, total solitary confinement. Guys can't even communicate with each other by kind of shouting underneath the doors, as they used to be able to in some of the other facilities. You know, some people have reported they didn't even know there were people in the cells next to them. And, you know, the thing it kind of evokes is, you know, notion of this sort of British female sailor who was taken prisoner and held in Iran. You know, everybody in England was sort of wondering, gee, why did these people sort of come onto, you know, TV and talk in such a kind of damaging way so quickly? And really all the Iranians did was kind of held people in solitary confinement. And in particular with that female sailor, they said, you know, look, you're the last one here. We sent all the other ones home. It's a really sort of psychologically distressing thing. And you combine it with things like the lack of tactile contact. You know, guards wear gloves when they move prisoners around, so they don't even experience sort of human touch. And the censors will black out words of affection from their, you know, from their family in the letters that do get through. I mean, all this combines to make it a real psychologically devastating experience. And, you know, every psychiatrist who's worked with torture victims that we've talked to will tell you that it's actually much harder to fix the damage from isolation than it is to fix the damage from physical brutality.
Well, Shane, maybe you know the first Supermax in the United States, and we litigated against them at the center, was actually designed by a psychiatrist. So they know precisely what they're doing to try to break down the human psyche.
Right, right. You know, one of the you know, nicest stories around this sort of thing to illustrate how damaging it is from the Korean War. And Joe Margulies recounts it in his book about Guantanamo. It sort of goes like this. A couple of U.S. pilots were shot down over North Korea. And then, you know, months later, they appeared on videotapes, you know, looking in perfectly fine health, no bruises or anything like that, admitting in extraordinary detail to a plot to sort of drop biological weapons over civilian populations in the North. And the highest-ranking guy who was shot down said this was no less than a plot to exterminate the civilian population, you know, through the use of, you know, weapons of mass destruction, basically. And military officials back home in the U.S. were scratching their heads saying, how do they do it? And, you know, the reality is all the Koreans did to them was held them in isolation and then had guards sort of mock them constantly. You know, it really shows, you know, demonstrates in a nice fashion, I think, how this is about the most devastating thing that you can do to someone is isolate them from other human beings.
Yeah, we had Al McCoy on the show about a year and a half ago. You remember, Michael? He's the University of Wisconsin professor who wrote the book on torture.
It's called The Question of Torture.
He had researched the development of these torture techniques going all the way back to the CIA in the 50s. It involved several countries and some of the major universities in America. And he said they spent millions and millions of dollars and finally came up with what he called touchless torture, that they invented ways to break people and agonize people without doing the usual, you know, removing the fingernails. And two people who were up before some kind of boards at Guantanamo, this week it was reported in the Times, both of them said they were tortured. I wanted to ask you about that, Shane. One of them said they were put in stress positions, and Al McCoy said that one of the things the CIA developed was stress positions. So people held the key to their
to their own situation. They were really torturing themselves. And that, he said, was like the most devastating thing to do to somebody, to make them torture themselves. And two of the people at Guantanamo said that that was what the United States was doing. Did you read about that, Shane?
I spoke on a panel with him a couple of weeks ago, and he really emphasized that notion of self-inflicted harm. You know, and it's funny because when you describe things to the public, the fingernails sound much, much worse than being forced to stand for 4 hours with your arms raised in front of you. But the psychological effect is what people aren't really sort of taking into account there.
I know you're talking about Mozambique, who's been released, but what I think we're referring to, and I know the center represents Majid Khan, who's one of the so-called high-value detainees, one of the 14 transferred from secret CIA sites around the world into Guantanamo, and they've been going through the process called the Combatant Status Review Tribunals. Why don't you give us a little overview, Shane, and some of the allegations about torture that have come out?
Sure. Well, you know, with these 14 high-value detainees, I mean, they were all, you know, what unites them is not necessarily that they are plausibly, you know, all people who are connected to terrorism, but rather that they all came from CIA black sites, and the reason the government held people there is, you know, so that they would have kind of free rein to do whatever they wanted to them. So the CSRT process is, in theory, it's both a means of justifying the military's detention by, you know, having a military panel come to a conclusion that someone's an enemy combatant, but it's also kind of the first step in the military tribunal process of actually putting someone on trial for, you know, being sort of a, you know, war criminal, terrorist, that sort of thing in the military system. You know, one of the many problematic things about these panels is that they are allowed to consider evidence that's produced through torture. It gives the government quite an incentive to torture people. So, you know, and one of the other problematic things is that the government gets to control all the evidence that's submitted. Not only can they use torture evidence, in some cases coming from other Guantanamo detainees who've been tortured, or other black site detainees who've been tortured, but they can use classified evidence which the detainee never gets a chance to see or rebut. And then, beyond that, the detainee doesn't get to bring in his own witnesses. And so that's where the statement that we submitted last week comes in. It turns out Majid Khan's brother, one of his brothers, lives in Pakistan. Most of the family is here in Baltimore. Majid Khan himself has asylum status in the United States, lived here, went to high school here. But one of his brothers lives in Pakistan and was actually sort of kidnapped with him and held in custody in Pakistan, along with the brother's wife and small child. His brother basically gave kind of a detailed account of what had happened to Majid Khan, at least while they were held together in Pakistan, you know, which included being sort of tied into stress positions until his hands and feet went numb, people sort of tightening the ropes every hour, being hooded constantly, being slapped in the face and deprived of sleep, being kept in a cell that's too small to even sort of stretch his legs out and so forth.
Right, he had to sit like with his knees drawn up, right?
In a
broom closet, essentially,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it kind of reminds you of what Maharar described, being in a grave, a 3x6 sort of room where he could kind of just stand up.
So Shane, where are we now on all these cases? What's going to happen next at Guantanamo?
Well, you know, with Khan, I think we're basically just waiting for the military to release the transcript of the CSRT. We know it took place this weekend because the AP reported a little bit on it. We know it lasted 3 days, in contrast to some of the others that were over in an hour. So it should be pretty interesting to see what comes out of all this. You know, Khan, you know, at least now...
Khan, right?
What's that? Yeah, for Majid Khan, right. Hopefully he knows that he is being represented by the center now. You know, the military has refused to allow our lawyers to go visit him on the grounds that they claim that he has all this classified information in his head, that, number one, he knows about the secret facilities where he was kept, he knows where they were located, which is kind of a surprising thing when you think that, you know, he was sort of probably, you know, whisked off in a hood to these places and kept in an isolation cell there. But putting that to one side, the other thing they're saying is that the torture techniques that were used on him are classified, that basically if they were to get out, then, you know, Al-Qaeda could figure out how to resist them. And so we can't tell you, you know, how we used coercive interrogation techniques on him.
Yeah, Al-Qaeda is going to figure out how to get people to breathe underwater so that waterboarding is no longer a problem.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, really.
What is very curious to me is you have about 300 and more people who've been released from Guantanamo, and you have individuals talking about the torture that they've suffered at the hands of the United States in this so-called war on terror. And the press is increasingly looking really bad for the Bush administration. They have a real problem here. So given this, and given the increased pressure in the campaigns to close Guantanamo Bay, why would they in Camp 6 do things like, you know, they open up a new camp where people are watched 24 hours a day. All the inmates are watched even while they're using the restroom, you know, the toilet in their cell. Where you have, after that scandal of women sexually harassing Guantanamo Bay inmates, why would you have female guards in Camp 6 now watching male inmates while they shower? It defies logic.
Right, right. I mean, I guess there's a, you know, couple sort of theories that kind of, you know, bounce around about this. You know, one is that by, you know, sort of creating conditions where everyone who's, you know, still there are going to be sort of under psychological distress, it, you know, it makes it less likely that the detainees are going to, you know, sort of work with their lawyers, that they're going to be in sort of any shape to kind of tell a credible story if they are released. You know, all these sort of things, you know, that would follow from, you know, sort of releasing people as sort of damaged goods psychologically. That's kind of the worst sort of spin that you can put on it. And I suppose the best is maybe that, you know, they have determined that, you know, however abusive these conditions might be, that they are preferable to having slightly increased chance that someone would be able to kill themselves at the base. I mean, the way these cells are set up, there's basically, you know, they're designed so that there's nothing you can use inside to hurt yourself in any way. You know, the furniture is made of concrete, that sort of thing.
In terms of the females watching the males take showers in Camp 6, I really do believe that that's just designed for humiliation. Knowing how much trouble they got in previously with having female guards sexually harass male inmates, it defies logic that they would think that this is just simply a pair of eyes doing a suicide watch. Mm-hmm. They could easily have a male do it.
Right.
Or
right.
You just remove everything from the shower that one could use to kill themselves.
I agree with that.
They're naked. What are they bringing in? They're probably cavity searched before they go into the shower. You remove everything.
I agree with that. That sounds right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what they were doing before, you know, the sort of things that were documented by Eric Saar in his book, the interrogator who kind of wrote a tell-all about, you know, the use of sort of sexual humiliation of female interrogators, kind of rubbing up against, you know, conservative Muslim sort of, you know, detainees. You know, that's almost a, you know, off the chart in terms of a different category of something that was just clearly planned to be psychologically damaging to a certain...
Yeah, you know, putting the hands in the pants and pulling out a handful of fake menstrual blood and then smearing it on detainees. I mean, that's blatant sexual humiliation and abuse.
AI issued a report on Camp 6, is that right?
Go to our website to either to amnesty.org or amnestyusa.org, and it's look for the Guantanamo report. It's called Cruel and Inhuman Conditions of Isolation for Detainees at Guantanamo Bay. That's the name of the new report. But to make it easier for listeners, we'll put it up on lawanddisorder.org, and people can link to it from there.
And AI, as well as I know Shane, the center has a campaign as well on Guantanamo. Can you tell people the website for that?
That's ccr-ny.org, and it may even be easier to just go to Google and, you know, Google Center for Constitutional Rights in Guantanamo, and you'll find it.
So thank you, Shane Cadedel from the Center for Constitutional Rights, the attorney in charge of the center's Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks, Shane.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Freeport.